And today we have one of the most prolific DJs in the city. That is a world-renowned name for Corners. What's popping with you, bro? How you doing?
So this is like my biggest, most important investment I think that I've made. And I'm like I said, I'm the most excited about it.
Yeah. Let's talk about
being black in China is different.
Different.
It's different.
Yes, sir.
The last time I was there was, I've been there a few times, but I would say the last time I was there, I think it was like 2019.
Okay.
And I brought my brother with me. I was on tour doing clubs, and he does photography and videography. Mm-hmm. So I got him to come with me and capture it. Mm-hmm. And just to roll with my bro. Mm-hmm. And in Shanghai, we got stopped several times to take pictures with people that were, they definitely don't know who I am.
Yeah.
They're just like, Black people.
Yep.
And they take pictures like, it's a real thing.
That's a fact. It happened to me too when
and,
I was out
and
there.
I'm not 6'8". So yeah. Like, imagine being like a basketball player over there.
God.
You are, well, you stand out. Because that was the first place in my life that I ever went that for blocks, and like, I'm going to say I walked like 3-4 blocks and saw nothing but Chinese people. Like, nothing but one race of people as far as the eye could see. After about 10 minutes, I saw like one white lady. But I've never been immersed in one culture like that. I'm from Toronto. There's everybody here all the time. Mm-hmm. Everywhere else I've been, you always see some, you know, mix of people. China was Chinese.
Yeah.
Chinese.
Yeah.
But then like you go to nightlife and like, you know, at the club, it was a mix.
Yeah.
Expats and mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But on the regular street where I was near my hotel the very first time I went there, I was like, whoa.
Yeah, well, it's this different.
This is not like anything I've ever experienced before. It was cool, though. I like culture shock. I don't love going to places that feel too close to, like too Western.
Yeah.
Like, I like to experience different cultures.
So, I agree with you to a point, but I dislike the experience I had in China.
Yeah, what happened?
So, I was only there for a day, by the way. And I was there for a layover to go to Thailand.
Okay, but you took time and you went into
the
city.
I took time, went to the city, really, like, went to the malls, went to different restaurants, tried food. Like, it was like a pretty immersive experience for a day.
Okay.
And when I was walking around, the eyes that I was getting was definitely strange. Mm-hmm. People thought I was an athlete. Like, I went into Foot Locker, they were like, a real one.
Yep. Literally a real one.
Yeah, exactly. Then one thing happened that always caught my eye, what you're saying with the pictures. Uh-huh. So my boy went to the ATM to get some cash out. So I'm standing like right behind him, but with my back turned to him, of course, because he's at the ATM.
Yeah.
So as I'm standing there, people are like walking past and like snapping pictures. And then this one girl had a whole plan. Her and her girl had a plan. So one girl walked ahead and then tried to do like a little swivel like with her phone, try to like turn around quickly. And then the other girl came behind me and they was doing like a...
Not cool.
Not cool.
Not cool.
Like, you know what I'm saying? Which is weird because they're trying to like, you know, almost like pet Z.
Yeah, like not cool. Like if you want to take a picture, come and say hello
come and say hi.
Attempt to have a, even if you don't speak English, just like motion. Can we?
Exactly. Exactly.
At least some level of politeness.
Exactly. So that kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
But then I asked if I want to take a picture. And I'm like, yeah, picture. And then people started joining in.
Oh,
like,
no. Yeah.
People started swarming, bro. Yeah. Then all of a sudden, people started running from anywhere.
Uh-huh. Like, yeah. I'm telling you, it's facts. You let one person,
yeah,
and the rest of them see it, be like, oh, it's open season now.
Exactly. Yeah, man. So that was very weird. And the thing is, too, in China, there's not much water. Did you notice that when you were in China?
What do you mean?
Bro, there was little, like, for example, the vending machines had no water in it.
Oh, like juice. Like bottled water.
Bottled water, water open. Like, they didn't have water open like that when I was in China.
I don't know that I noticed that.
Yeah, and the other thing too, bro, is that there's no Google or Facebook. That's a big one. I know you.
Oh yeah. Their government locks down things on the internet very much. So most people that I know there are all using VPNs.
Exactly. Yep. So getting from the airport to our hotel was a challenge. Mm-hmm. Because we actually had it printed out, bro. Like, printed out the directions to try and get there. And then we gave it to the taxi driver. And then on the highway, he was like, do I go this way or go this way?
Like, and we're like, how do you know?
Exactly. So it was a challenge, you know. Luckily, our boy had a work phone. So he snuck the GPS on the work phone. And then, you know, we finessed it. But
I I definitely have a different travel experience than most because I'm always traveling as an artist.
Yeah.
So there's like certain things like that, like the ride from the airport to the hotel or whatever is handled. So I don't generally have to navigate those kinds of things.
Swag.
So I thankfully don't, you know, run into the roadblocks that I have though. Like when I travel on my own, like there was one time, bro, I was in Singapore and I had a few days in between gigs. Mm-hmm. I was playing like one gig in Singapore and then another one in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And I had like some time in between. Mm-hmm. And they just hooked me up at the hotel for the time. But I was talking to one of my brethren in New York and he's like, he goes to Asia all the time. He's like, bro, why don't you go somewhere? It's so cheap to fly around in Asia once you're there. Mm-hmm. And I checked online and like every flight to other countries were all like $100, $150. So I kind of just spun the wheel in my head. I was like, okay, well, where can I go?
And the economy spun
and
the globe.
I landed on, it was in between Bali and Thailand. Mm. And I was like, well, I don't really want to go to Bali by myself and just go chill on a beach. So let me go to Bangkok because it's like a big city. Let me go experience something. And I went, did not know there was a massive demonstration, like protest happening against the government. And all of the transit was shut down. And nobody speaks English there, by the way. So I had to find my way from the airport to the hotel without any English, without a printed out anything. Ooh. I made it. It took me a while.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the streets were all blocked off and stuff.
Because of the protests.
Yeah, I ended up, I was there for 2.5 days, I think. But I ended up having a good time.
How did you finesse that? How did you make your way back? What was like the strategy you developed?
Honestly, I just looked at signs and figured it out. Like because I'm well-traveled, I guess, the instincts kicked in. But like I just had to figure it out.
That's a dope story, man.
But it makes me like, it's like a survival thing that like, yo, I did that. Like, I'm not out in the wilderness, like in the woods or something, killing raccoons to live. But like, I figured out how to move in a city where nobody spoke English for 3 days.
That's pretty big.
Yeah.
That's pretty big. Listen, when I was in Thailand, I got lost for a minute and I was like, what am I going to do?
Like, this might be it.
Luckily, there was the tuk-tuk, so I just took a tuk-tuk back and it was solid. But like, that's impressive, bro. You know, what's interesting about that is that from China to Thailand, the difference the people showed was crazy.
Well, that's the thing. We kind of think of Asia as like one thing.
Homogeneous, yeah.
It is not. It's very, each country is very distinct.
Very different.
It's just like Europe as an example or Africa is like different countries, completely different cultures, different vibes, everything.
Yeah.
Even though the people may look similar.
So who was the worst? Who was the worst who gave you the worst reception?
In Asia?
Yeah, in Asia and in Europe.
Asia. I've had no bad times in Asia, man. Honestly,
really?
Asia's been pretty good to me. Europe, I went to Bulgaria one time. Don't go to Bulgaria. Just don't go to Bulgaria. Worst.
Wow.
Worst. I felt like I was the only black person in the country.
Yeah.
And everybody hated that I was there. I was with my girlfriend at the time. She's part Bulgarian.
Okay.
But she lived there like over a decade prior to our trip.
Mm-hmm.
And she had really, really, really red dyed hair at the time, like flaming red. So she stood out. I stood out. They looked at us like, what the hell are you doing here?
Wow.
The entire time. And she speaks Bulgarian, but dated. Like her accent is not sharp because she hasn't been there.
Yeah.
So as soon as she started to talk, you could tell they're looking at her like, nah.
Otis.
They're like, nah.
Yeah.
Like imagine going to Yard with a fake Jamaican accent. People are going to look at you like, no.
You know, not in Jamaica.
Nope.
Then you don't even have to go to them. By the time you walk close to them, they look at you and you're like, foreigner.
That's exactly what it was. Yeah, they saw us. They looked at her. They looked at me. They looked at her. They're like, nah.
Yeah.
The reception for everything was just no.
Yeah. That's interesting, bro. But man, that's some blessing though, you know? And ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Hustle Over Everything. This is the podcast where we receive stories, tips, and tactics from entrepreneurs who have done it. I'm Alex, and today we have one of the most prolific DJs in the city. That is a world-renowned name for Corners. What's popping with you, bro?
What's popping? What's popping? You're gonna mash up your own things, bro.
Jeez. Look at this, bro. Ladies and gentlemen, I just dropped the mic.
but it's all good. MV7, built to last.
Exactly. Most definitely. So, yo, let's get into your story, man, because I find it very interesting. And one question I'm not going to ask you is how you became a DJ for the Raptors. I know you get asked that a million times.
Every single time.
You know?
If you want to know that, it's on the internet. Just Google it.
Just Google it, you know? I want to start off with a segment that we are introducing to the pod.
Okay.
A new segment. And that segment is called Deal or No Deal.
All right.
You ready for this?
I'm ready.
All right. So, his situation. You get hit up by one of your homeboys from time that you know you have a love for.
Okay. And where is this going? I don't know. Let's go.
They're like, yo, Kirk, my guy, I'm launching my first conference and I need a DJ for it. It's my first time launching a conference and my money is tight. But yo, we go way back. Can you do it for me for free?
Okay.
The next one, I got you, hands down. But this one, I need it for the free. Deal or no deal?
Wait, what? Aren't they? They're both free?
No. The next time I got you.
Next time. Okay.
Next time I got you, I'm gonna pay you.
Oh, you're saying deal or deal? No deal or no deal on that scenario?
On the first one, deal or no deal.
This is my brethren.
This is your brethren from time.
Say less. It's done.
It's done.
It's done. I take care of my people.
Interesting.
If it's somebody that I don't know.
Yeah.
Nah.
Interesting.
If it's a cold call, absolutely not.
Of course not. Yeah.
But if it's my, you know, somebody that I consider close,
yeah
absolutely. Absolutely. No question.
The homie discount.
Not even
that.
The discount. The homie, like, yo, I want to see you win. Like, yeah. You're starting something that's real. Let's do it. How can I help?
I appreciate that. Because sometimes people are like, all right, if it's the homie, if it's the friend from time, I'll give you a percentage off. But I respect the fact that you went completely free.
No, this is not. Yeah, this is not the homie saying, yo, I'm throwing up a party. Come, can you come DJ? This is like, yo, I'm starting a conference.
Yeah.
It's like, yo, that's work. You're building something. I love that. Let's go.
That's solid, bro. That's solid. Awesome, man. So let me ask you something. What was your first free gig?
All of them. When I first started out, I hope people understand. I need you to understand. When you're starting any business, the money doesn't come on day one. Probably not day two, day three, or day four either. You got to figure it out. And for me, starting off in this business as a DJ, it's like, I have to give people a reason to want to pay me something. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, there is no reason. It's like, I was like an intern, essentially. So I used to not even just play for free. I used to, you know, in order to even get the opportunity to play anywhere, I started by giving out flyers for local promoters. I started showing up early to my favorite DJ's gigs to like help them carry in their records, his records at the time, to like gain their favor. And they let me, you know, to get to know them and they like, you know, let me hang out in the DJ booth because I was already going to parties. And, you know, I'd made some friends that were DJs. Mm-hmm. But when I started to show them the flex that like, yo, I'm getting into DJing, like a lot of people say a lot of things. So I wanted to show them that I was serious. Mm-hmm. So I showed up. You know what I mean? I offered help.
This podcast is brought to you by Narai Cellars Wine, one of the only black-owned wine companies in Canada. So not only are you supporting the show, but you're supporting black ownership. Now, who is Narai Cellars Wine? They have 10 years of experience in winemaking. So what we're going to do is going to hit the link below and visit NaraiCellars.ca and try the wine for yourself. Let's get back into the show.
Yeah, so before I was able to start getting paid for gigs, I used to do whatever it is that I had to do. I wasn't even getting free gigs yet. I was trying to get gigs, period. So I used to hand out flyers for promoters. I used to show up early and help DJs carry their crates of records. And, you know, try to, like, gain their favor, get to, you know, be on their good side. They let me hang out in the DJ booth, watch what they do and how they do it. And then I would go home and practice on my dad's turntables and try to figure out how to do what I saw. But until I was paying those dues enough to get a shot that, you know, a couple that I'm like, all right, cool. And those first few gigs were, you know, just coming open for me. And after that, it started to become, okay, well, I'll give you, you know, a couple $100 here or whatever. And then it grew from there. So early on, I did several gigs for free. Several.
Do you have a janky promoter story?
Plenty.
What comes to mind? I felt like there was one that came right to the front of your brain.
Honestly, it's always the same shit. It's just like you do the work and you don't get paid. You have to chase them for money. Mm. Thankfully, I've turned the corner, no pun intended, long ago, that's not really a thing that happens anymore. But surprisingly enough, the odd time, it is still like a bit of a tooth pull. But that's Omar's job to chase them now.
He's your manager?
Yeah.
Okay, amazing. Now, one thing I actually talked to Akil about, our mutual friend, is when it comes to being a DJ, there's actually people that book you for gigs. And there's ways to like go on different websites that you get booked for gigs. Have you used any of those?
Like DJ agency
type things? like a median website, like kind of like an Airbnb for DJs.
No, I've never done that.
Really? Okay, cool.
No.
I always wanted to know if there's a DJ listening, like what options they can have to get gigs quicker. You know, what solutions do you have for that DJ that's like, all right, I have been practicing, I'm honing in my craft, and I want to get into those spaces to start promoting myself and start, you know, getting that real life experience. Is just going to a club straight and just talking to somebody or like?
My advice for that is the same that I give for pretty much any business that you're trying to get into. Make some space for yourself in the spaces where the thing happens. So if you're trying to be a DJ and you want to DJ in clubs, go to clubs. Go to the clubs that you want to DJ at.
Yeah.
Meet the people that make it happen. Not on a pushy, yo, I want to spin here, you know, give me a shot. Just like go and support, be a patron. You know, like I said, I went and made friends with the people who were making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Not even just on some, I want to get something out of them. Just like, yo, I love this and I want to be around it. And from that, the things come. You know what I mean? When given the opportunity, I was like, yo, here's my CD. And eventually that turned into, like the turning point was like for one of my first major gigs. There was a promoter who's one of my brethren to this day by the name of Ian Andre Espine. And he was one of the first promoters that was doing big parties at that time. That gave me a shot. It was an opening slot. It was like 10 p.m. till 10:25 p.m. before anybody was even in the club. But I was on it, and I was on the flyer, and I got to, you know, get my feet wet in there. But it was a blizzard. I was hired to do flyers for him, and I showed up. Me and my partner at the time, we showed up. And he was like, all right, you've shown me something tonight. Next opportunity I have, I'm going to put you on a party. So my advice is like show up, go to the thing that you want to be a part of. Like, you know, if you want to be a podcaster, you can start a podcast, yes, but also it would be a good idea to meet other podcasters, get on other podcasts. How do you do that? You got to meet people, you know, maybe if there's a conference or something, or if there's anything where you can go where you know podcasters are going to be at, go there, you know, be in the room.
That's huge. That's a fact. This ambulance passed by.
Toronto thing.
It's a Toronto thing for sure. You know what I'm saying? All right. As you make it into those rooms, start to grow your brand, what was the people around you saying? You know, because you're starting to build up your brand and, you know, the people around you start to change as you build your career up. You know, how did your friends and family have to take your career rising?
My family was supportive once they started to see motion. I mean, my dad was always supportive. My mom was very apprehensive just based on her wanting me to be okay. Like, I know she never had any malice toward me chasing my dreams, but she was worried that I wouldn't be able to feed myself because this is not a go to school, get a job type of thing.
For sure.
My friends were, it was lit. They got to come to the club and have fun and, you know, get to be on the list or just roll in with me or get some free drinks or whatever. That was never a problem for them. They loved that.
And your parents were into music too, right?
My dad was. My dad was a musician first, and then he became a chef when he settled down, so to speak, and like when I was born and all of that. But he was always a creative person. He was later picked up photography and was being a photographer. I used to go with him on gigs and be his assistant. He figured out how to build computers. So my dad was just that dude that whatever he wanted to do, he just figured it out.
He was just like right brain, you know,
yeah, the creative side. I get a lot of that from him for sure.
And yeah, and it kind of echoes into you because you're not just into DJing, you're into making music, you're into producing, you play instruments, you know. Is that the thread that kind of connects you to?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everything in me that's about music comes from my dad, for sure. I grew up with a massive record collection and instruments in the house. He encouraged me, he and my mom, but like mostly he, because he was in that, encouraged me to take piano lessons as a kid. That led to me being in bands in elementary school and high school, and it was always music. And I didn't even know I wanted to do this as a career.
What did you want to do?
I went to university to be a writer. Really? Like through high school, I was a gifted writer, so my teachers always told me, and were like always kind of funnel me in that direction. They're like, yo, you should be a writer, like creative writing, poetry, journalism, something to do with writing, because I just had this thing with words. Yeah. And when I was graduating high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do, so I went to York University for journalism.
Yeah.
And I went there for 2 years and hated it, and I dropped out. But during that time is when I discovered nightclubs and like the party scene and DJ culture, and that kind of took over from where the writing was. I was like, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore. I can't sit in this classroom and talk about one paragraph for 3 hours. This is way more exciting. And then I, at York, they had a radio, I mean, they still have a radio station on campus. I wandered into there, met some people there, hung around enough that these girls that had a show on Tuesday mornings asked me to bring some records one day and spin with them. And then I ended up being a part of that show. And all of that was just like, for the love of what it was. I didn't even know that it could be a career at that point. I was just like so fascinated by it. Mm-mm. And it led me to be like, you know what? At some point, I was just like, this is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. I hear that, man. And your pops passed about like 4 years ago, 5 years ago now?
9 years ago, almost 10 now.
9 years ago.
Yeah, this year is going to be 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
Man, do you ever heal from that, honestly?
Recently, yeah.
Yeah?
It took a while. I actually started therapy 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And my main reason for going was I knew I needed to deal with that. Because he's my hero. He's my guy. Mm-hmm. And like I recognized that I didn't really properly process it. And the thing that was really messing with me is like I was starting to realize that I was being distant to my family, especially my older family members. And I could like rationalize, yeah, I'm like kind of putting up a wall so that if and when the time comes that they pass, it's not going to hurt as much. And I knew it was messed up, but I still couldn't find the strength to pick up the phone or to go visit as much as I knew I should. And eventually I was like, you know what? I gotta man up and deal with this. So yeah. I was able to find a therapist that like I liked on the first try, which was amazing.
Wow.
And the way that I was able to find a therapist like that is like my daughter's mom actually is a therapist now. She used to be in banking and she changed careers. I asked her for a recommendation because she knows me very well. So I was like, yo, who do you know in your field that you think I would vibe with? I want a black male of Caribbean descent that is near my age. Because I don't want to have to explain stuff that just, you know, I don't want to spend time explaining, you know, the way I was brought up or culture. I just want to be able to talk.
Yeah.
And she gave me a few options, but she's like, yo, but this one, I think you would really vibe. And I linked him first and immediately we hit it off. And to this day, that's who I talk to once a week.
Man, that's
incredible. Like that really helped me push through the processing of my dad's passing. And now it's like, obviously I'm still sad. Obviously I still miss him. But I don't feel the same way that I did before. I know that I've like dealt with it much better now. And it's more happy memories than there are like resistance at this point. So necessary. Go to therapy if you're not in therapy. It's so dope. Yeah. And like beyond that, it's helped me in like a whole bunch of other ways that like I did not even anticipate, wasn't my plan. I just wanted to deal with this. And from it, all this other stuff started to come up and help me evolve into the person that I am today, which is like very different than I was 2 years ago.
Yeah. No, it's beautifully said, man. You know, it's a metaphor that I usually have that's called like the truck metaphor.
Okay.
When it comes to therapy, is as men, especially as black men, you know, I told you this to you, Isaac, you know, we're driving around our truck, and as things happen to us, it hits against our windshield and we catch it, and you're like, oh, I can't deal with this. throw it in the back of the truck. You know? And then you get another thing and you just get another one, throw it in the back of the truck. And you just keep throwing. It
gets heavy.
And before you know it, it gets heavy and it's weighing you down and your truck is going at like a mile per hour speed. And you're like, what's going on? Why am I feeling this heaviness? And then you finally go to something like a therapy, get yourself to express yourself, and you let it all out, you know?
You gotta offload that shit, bro.
You gotta offload that shit.
I'm very, very happy to be able to say that I've offloaded most of it.
Yeah.
I'm not all the way there yet, where I feel like I'm still a work in progress.
Yeah.
But like where I am now compared to where I was before I started,
yeah,
I'm a whole different person.
And you're going to keep getting those rocks.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So and then, like, yeah, the rocks don't stop. The
rocks don't stop.
They don't stop. Mm-hmm. But, like, now when they come, I deal with them different. I don't throw them in the back anymore. I handle them. I handle it.
You handle it. You look at it.
I handle it.
Space. And like,
yeah.
I feel like, you. I see you rock.
You hear me?
I feel, yeah, yeah.
Took that thing back on the road.
Word. Whip that shit. You know what I'm saying? That's a fact. Yeah, yeah. And it gives you, like, a calmness almost. You know, because you realize that I've dealt with this rock before.
Yeah. There's no rock that I can't handle.
Yeah,
calm is a great word. I feel so calm
and
like at peace now. I like what they say is Zen.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what I think it is. Like I'm not a Buddhist monk or anything of that level, but I definitely feel like when people ask me, you know, how you're doing, how things going or whatever, I'm like, yo, everything's calm, yo.
Yeah.
Everything is smooth. Like, no, it's not perfect, but what is perfect? Define perfect. I'm walking in my purpose. I'm being intentional in what I do and where I go and who I spend my time with.
Mm-hmm.
Things are lovely.
Yeah,
things are calm.
Was it calm for you when you first started DJing at the Raptors?
No. Super not calm. Super not calm. Very chaotic.
Yeah.
Well, it was like a combination of things because, number one, the role had not been defined. I was the first one to do it.
DJ.
First sports DJ in Canada.
Damn.
We were figuring it out as we went. The only reason why they even considered it is now I'm telling the story how I got to be the Raptors DJ.
See how I didn't ask you? You see that?
I see what you did there. So I'm not going to, I'll breeze over it. But like the suits, the higher ups, the decision makers at Maple Leaf Sports saw DJ Iree, the Miami Heat DJ, who I will always give ratings to because he's the OG. He's like the originator of this. They went to a game in Miami. They saw him performing at the game. And they were like, yo, this is dope. They didn't say dope. I don't imagine they said dope. They said, this is great. This is fantastic. We would love to have this in Toronto. But clearly they're not in touch with the culture, the DJ scene. They wouldn't know who to pick. And thankfully, the stars were aligned that a gig that I took, which was DJing in-store at Roots Canada, which was like my first steady paying DJ gig ever, I was doing an event for them. I don't like how you made me tell this story.
I didn't. I just asked you if it was
or not. Long story short, the VP of marketing saw me there. We exchanged information. She loved what I was doing, me and my partner at the time. And we got the opportunity to start DJing at the games. And it was a new thing. They didn't even really look at what Miami was doing. They were just like, okay, this is Toronto. What are we going to do? They set up a folding table in one of the tunnels where people walk back and forth. And we're like, all right, let's figure out what music you're going to play and how. And it was nerve-wracking because not only had I never played in a room that big before, but, and the echo is crazy. Like, I have a speaker right beside me, a monitor speaker is what we call it, to like have the direct sound because if I'm listening to the speakers up top, they're so far that the sound travel, it takes time. So like there's mad, and there's lots of speakers, there's mad echoes. There's no way I could accurately mix records that way. So I never played a room that big. And also there wasn't really a plan.
Yeah.
Like it was just, they had my my managers at the time, was a different manager, not Omar. She would just be like sitting there with a headset on, be like, okay, they said play music, play something right now. And like I would play something. And that's literally how it started.
That's wild.
Now it's a well-oiled machine. We've like, we got it down. But at that time, it was chaotic. And I was hands shaking, hoping that I don't mess up. I was playing real records at the time. This was 05. So it was before digital DJing is what it is now. Mm-hmm. So I was playing actual records. So I'm just like praying that the records don't skip. All of these things were happening. It was literally just like a project table, like what you would have at school.
The foldable joint.
Table. Like folding table. Wow. Like every with a skirt on it. Yeah. Everything about it was Mad Bandulu, but we made it from that to where it is now, where I have like a whole LED spaceship type DJ booth in the arena.
Nice, man. So you're like one of like the forefathers of creating that DJ space for Toronto when it comes to the Raptors. And what's challenging about that is there's no guardrails. So, but there's a lot of risk if you mess up anything.
But high risk, high reward.
That's a fact. So you must have been stressed out of your mind.
Yeah, the first few games, definitely.
Yeah.
And then getting through the first season felt great. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, I hope they call back. Mm-hmm. I hope they call back. And then they called back and did it again, but expanded on the role.
Yeah.
And after a few years, it just became a given. Because I'm like on a yearly contract, even to now, like I'm a contractor. I'm not an employee of Maple Leaf Sports.
Oh, okay.
My company is contracted by their company.
Okay.
So every year I get a contract and I resign. Mm. But at this point, it's like, it's a formality.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, it was like, please, 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 please,
please.
Because I didn't know, like, we didn't have anything to gauge it against.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was just like, do they like it? Yes or no?
Mm-hmm.
And are they willing to continue to spend this money and figure this out, add this extra thing that they never had before?
Mm.
But they saw the value in it, they saw the value in me, and they kept it going.
The more subscribers we have, the better the guests get. So please hit subscribe. Let's get back into the show. How has your perspective on sports and entertainment changed over the years when it comes to working and DJing with the Raptors?
A lot. Because again, like I said, when I first started, it didn't exist in this country.
Yeah.
We made it up
and
we figured out ways to make it work and add to the experience of people coming to a game and enjoying the sport that they came to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing where it has evolved to, it's almost like, why was it not always a thing?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to have music at sporting events, which there always have been music from since the beginning of time. But like earlier on, I guess there would have been bands, like marching bands or whatever at football and stuff like that, or college basketball, you know, they have the school bands and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as things got to the point where it's like, you know, music being played through speakers, it only makes sense that the person choosing the music is a curator of rooms with music. And who better to pick for that than a DJ, who our job literally is innately to read the energy in a room and play the right music at the right time. So that now seems like, well, duh.
Right.
But like back then, it was not that. Now at this point, most professional sports teams have DJs or some form of a music curator who is an expert. But at that time, which is not even that long ago, it was like almost unheard of. To be fair though, even when I was DJing in store, that was not a regular thing that time either. Like I'm the first DJ that I know of that DJed in a store on a regular basis.
Mm.
Now it's, you go at any mall anywhere in the world and you might see a DJ.
Yeah, they need to bring more of those because some of them store music be horrible.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
The ones that don't have DJs that are like big enough stores, they just don't want to spend the money.
For sure. For sure. And maybe gyms too. Some gyms could use some DJs because gym music, Lord have mercy. Oh, my days. You ever forget your headphones and go to the gym and you listen to that music? That is horrible.
You want to hear something wild? I don't think I've told this story. I had a gig at a gym every Thursday afternoon. It was at Spadina and King and Spadina, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be a gym there. The owner of the gym was also a part-time DJ. He saw me at a Raptors game and asked me if I would be interested in DJing at his gym. And I was like, something about it just told me, it's like, all right, let me give it a shot. I never thought of that being a thing. But also, this is early enough in my career that I wasn't DJ. Although I was already the Raptors DJ, that was still very fresh. And like, I was DJing in clubs, but I was still like looking for like, what else could there be? You know, especially after the Raptors thing came out, I was like, this is way more than just nightclubs. Let me explore different options. So he asked me to come DJ in the gym. And they actually had a cool DJ booth set up because he's a DJ. So he set it up proper. And I was DJing there for a bit. One of the trainers there was also a nightclub promoter. And we got to, you know, building, and he had an opportunity to book a DJ for a small room inside the government nightclub. Do you remember the government?
Of course. Come on now.
It was called the Deluxe Lounge at the time. Mm-hmm. And like they were trying to figure out what to do with that room because it was like a small room encased in glass overlooking the main room where they had like big international house DJs playing every Saturday. And they thought maybe, you know, they could make it a little hip hop room. So they tried a few different DJs and it wasn't working. And this guy that happened to be working at the gym, who happened to like just be trying to get in as a promoter there and got the idea to like, yo, let me see if I can get you booked there. And he did. And I did one Saturday and they were like, we like him, bring him back. So I did another Saturday, ended up being a resident at that club for like 8 years.
8 years.
And it came from DJing at the gym.
That's from the gym. Okay, got you, got you. Damn. Well, it came from DJing at the Raptors.
True. That, yeah, but like, yeah, it's a chain of events.
Chain of events, yes.
But like, if you want to take it back, like DJing at the Raptors came from DJing at Roots Canada.
Yeah, that's a fact.
So like, the point of it all that I'm trying to make is opportunities beget other opportunities.
For sure.
And have you ever read the book, The Alchemist?
I have the book, but I haven't read it yet.
Okay, I urge you, read that book. It's one of my, maybe my favorite book ever. The premise of the book, you'll read the story and it's a really dope story, but like in the story, there's a overall overarching theme. Mm-hmm. And the lesson of it is the universe is always conspiring to lead you to where you need to be, but you have to listen. You have to like be in tune. You got to be in the right vibration and like be open to what they call in the book, omens, good omens. I call it following your gut.
Yeah, omens.
Omens sounds, I don't like, I don't know that. Right. But like, The idea of it that I took is like, yo, following your gut, following your intuition. Like, if something feels like, you know what, I should try that, do it. Don't question it. Do it. There's a reason why you feel that way. And like, I felt like the reason why I did even took the Roots gig was one of those things. Mm-hmm. The reason why I took the gym gig was one of those things.
Yeah.
And this thing, these things always led me to something else.
Yeah.
I never planned to be an in-store DJ. Mm-hmm. And that was never my end goal. It wasn't even, I didn't even know it was an option. It wasn't until it was. Mm-hmm. But that ended up landing me one of the biggest deals of my life. And then this other situation, which was like DJing in a gym. Again, I did not know that that was even a thing. But something about it was like, yeah, let me give it a try. And that led me to like my first major club residency. And like arguably my DJ career in clubs started in that room.
Wow.
I cut my teeth there. Like I really learned to walk in that spot.
Yeah. We have a phrase called Bridge of Incidents.
Mm.
Shout out to Owen. Where each step you take creates its own bridge to its own thing. And you can never copy anybody else's path because everyone else is creating their own bridge throughout their own journey.
That's definitely it,
man.
That's a real thing. I can attest to it. My whole life is that.
That's beautiful, bro. All right, so now, you're developed at this point, you know, in your storyline. Where do you kind of go from here? You know, is this when you start to go into music and start to produce more?
At that point, no. My goals at that time were to travel. I wanted to tour. I always wanted to, even when I first got into DJing and I had my mentors that I looked up to, the guys that I used to help carry records into the club and like be a fly on the wall in their DJ booth. I always wondered why so many of them were local. And I don't mean that in like a bad way. I'm just like, I had seen evidence on YouTube and other stuff that like, yo, there's DJs that like fly around and play different clubs in different parts of the world. It's like, how come my guys don't do that? And I got to realize that like, no, they didn't want to because they were killing it here. They were the top dogs here. And like everybody's path is different. What everybody wants out of things is different. So I was like, well, that's cool for you and you're blessed. Cool. But I want to do this. So I was starting to try to figure out, well, how do I travel? Like, how do I get booked? I'm getting booked like crazy in Toronto now. But how do I get booked in Montreal? How do I get booked in Vancouver? How do I get booked in you know, Edmonton, Calgary. And then beyond that, how would I get booked in the States? How do I get booked in Europe? And I really wanted to DJ in Europe. I don't know what about it really just drew me. I think it was like just culture shock. I was like, I really want to go somewhere that's different. And I don't know if I was ready for Asia yet. So I was like, Europe, you know, France, Spain, like these places seem cool. I see them on TV. I see them on the internet. I would love to be able to go experience those things. But like, I want to go DJ. I don't want to just go. I want to go DJ. How do I do that? And that was my main focus at that time. And I finessed it. I figured it out by connecting with people. Like my first contact in Canada to travel, where there's these promoters in Vancouver named G-Man and Risk, and they were killing shit. They were like the big dogs out there doing all the biggest parties. And I saw a couple DJs that I knew from Toronto would get flown out there. So I was working at Rogers Wireless Customer Service at this time. That was my day job. And I remember spending my time at work while on the phone emailing those promoters and other promoters trying to like get on. And I just shot my shot. And those promoters in particular were like, I spoke to the main guy who was doing the bookings. And he was like, don't know who you are. I'm not going to book you. So I was like, okay. So I just kept working on what I was doing here. Hit him again after I got the Raptors and like things were starting to move and I was starting to like build a little bit of name. He was like, okay, I started to hear about you, but still like there's not really much reason. So here what? I'll pay you $500 for you and your partner. I had an MC at the time. $500 flat. You got to fly here on your own. You got to get your own hotel room. So I was like, okay, hold on. And I checked what that cost. And it wasn't going to work. Like a flight for one person back and forth to Vancouver was like $800. So it would be $1,600 for us to fly there, plus whatever it cost for a hotel. And we were not making bank at the time. So I was like, all right, you know what? Respectfully, I'm not going to be able to do that just yet. But I'm keep a pin in this. And then got my weight up a little bit more and then hit him up. He's like, okay, no, I hear you guys are making noise. We'll fly you out. Still pay you $500, but we'll fly you out and we'll put you in a hotel. So me and my brethren flew out and split $500. But we were excited to do it because, yo, these guys put us on a plane to come go play at these big-ass clubs out west. We're getting out of the city. It's happening. And from there, the next step was, oddly enough, I met a dude from Belgium on MySpace.
On MySpace.
Yeah. Wow. And sorry, before that, there was a promoter in Edmonton that one of his brethren there in Edmonton was Polish and had some links in Poland. Mm-hmm. Somehow we ended up going to DJ in Poland. That was my first time in Europe. DJed all over Poland, drove all over the country. Again, felt like the only black people there, but we did that shit. And after that, on the way back, we stopped in Barcelona and spent 3 days there just chilling. I got home. I was like, that's it for me. I've seen too much. I cannot ever be happy with just being in Canada anymore. So I just like tried to figure out, like make contacts, get this to happen. Met my boy Jay Psar on MySpace. Finessed the situation to just fly myself and my partner over to Belgium to play for whatever. Mm-hmm. We paid for the flights. We were like, whatever you can pay us, just pay us. Played in some like little shitty bars and whatever, but we were in Europe. Did that a few times, started making a name. He was able to connect us with a promoter in Paris. I didn't know at the time, but Paris is like the center of this shit. Like if you were, especially at that time, if you were killing it in Paris, you were good everywhere. Because in every club, everywhere in the world, there's always a French guy. In the management, in the bookings, like there's always a French guy. They really are deep in the club business. So played this gig in Paris, and from there it just like spiderwebbed out to everywhere.
Yeah, that's they call that the piñata.
Yeah,
you know.
Yep,
you keep swinging. That's the one piñata that knocks everything out.
That was Paris. Was it? Mm. Paris was it. And the place that we played was this place called Gibus. Gibus. Mm. It's not there anymore, but it was a legendary hip hop club that, prior to being a hip hop club, was a legendary like rock venue. So like this shit went back to like the 60s or some shit. And it was very, very famous. Mm. We didn't know anything. We just went. Killed it. They brought us back a few times, and it just the legend started growing. Mm. But at that time, that was a long way to tell you. At that time, my focus was just travel. Yeah. I wasn't thinking about making music. I was thinking about anything but travel. I want to DJ everywhere. Four corners of the world.
Love it, bro. And you actually manifested that from the naming yourself that and
yes, sir.
Going through with it. What was the amount of volume it took to make those connections? Like, out of 100 emails you're sending out, how much were actually converting into net new connections?
Very low percentage. I couldn't tell you the number, but like very low, less than 10%.
Mm. But that's the gem right there.
Yeah, but like the connections, the ones that did work, I nurtured the fuck out of those ones. Mm. Like I really, like everybody that I'm naming, they're all friends to this day. Like we're real, actual friends. Mm. And that's like, I think that's the best part of what I've been able to do is work with people that I love to work with. Work with people that I actually enjoy mm-hmm. their company. And like, I rock with them, like mm-hmm. for real. Not just on some business, like if you're here, come to my house.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's go eat. I can come to your country and like, I might not even be DJing. I'll just pass through and like, let's hang out.
Yeah.
Like that type of relationship. Real, actual relationships.
That's awesome. Cause especially in the modern relationship, everyone's so networky.
Yeah, no, not transactional, actual, yeah. real, legitimate friendships and relationships.
I struggle with that. I struggle with developing strong bonds, you know, especially with a podcast, you're constantly meeting net new people.
Yeah.
So it's hard to like really get in and develop net new relationships. Any tips for that?
I don't know. For me, it's just like be myself. Just like authentically myself. I'm not ever putting on any kind of front. I'm not ever trying to pretend. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't believe in act as if. I believe in showing up as who you are. Mm-hmm. And the people that rock with you will rock with you, and the people that don't are not for you.
Fair.
And that's never steered me wrong. Mm. And like following the gut, following the omens. Mm-hmm. But if my spirit doesn't take somebody, doesn't matter what they can do for me.
So you know you're Caribbean. the tech,
if it's like, you know what I mean? If you know what it, you know what that feels like. And if it, if it's off, I'm like, I'm not going to go down that road because that just means that I'm going to have to be around somebody that I don't vibe with more than I would ever want to. Mm-hmm. I only want to be around people that I vibe with.
I hear that. That's real. And sometimes the check requires you to be around people that you don't like. Do you neglect the check for people to be around people you don't like, or you're like, all right, I'll get it done for the check?
I would be lying if I said I'd never neglected my feelings for the check, but I don't make a habit of it. And at this point in my career, I don't do it at all. Mm. I would rather not. But I remember having conversations with promoters like early days. Like I was DJing at maybe two clubs. Mm-hmm. And if I did not have one of those gigs, it would really hurt my pocket. Mm-hmm. But I remember specifically being like, yo, don't disrespect me. Mm-hmm. I would rather sit at home and not DJ anywhere than to come here to be treated like this. Mm-hmm. And I've had to call some bluffs. Mm-hmm. And I've left certain situations that were not right for me based on my reasons. Mm-hmm. Like I have my path, my trajectory, where I want to go with my career and how I want to feel as a person. And anything that's not in line with that has to go. So like I've walked away from, you know, I talked about the government was like my first big residency. I walked away from the government because there was a point where I wanted to expand what I was doing and DJ at more clubs and play more music. Like what I did there, they wanted a hip hop night. Why it worked is because I played everything. Like I was literally playing everything. And no other room in the whole club. There was like seven rooms in this mega club. Every room had its own specific style. My style was open format, mixed bag, whatever. You're gonna hear, you know, the hardest hip hop, you're gonna hear rock, you're gonna hear Motown, you're gonna hear like whatever vibe. Wherever the vibe went, that's what it was going to be. And I put it together in such a way that like not a lot of people were doing at that time. They then moved me to a bigger room. And that room started to turn. The promoter in that room really wanted it to be an all hip hop room. So he was pushing for that. And I was like, that's not what you promised me. We were doing fine in the small room. You said coming to this big room, I would just do what you do. And then it wasn't that. And I had to make a choice. Do I continue? And then they put it on the air. It was on the radio, live to air. So now my music is getting played around the city, but it's not. As much as I love hip hop and I was a hip hop kid, I didn't want to be branded as just a hip hop DJ because being black DJs playing hip hop, it cut off other options for you because racism, straight up. Like, there's no other way to put it. You can't shake that stigma or what was a stigma at the time because they would say things like, okay, well, no, we can't have you play here because you don't fit the vibe. What's the vibe? You know what I mean? Or they would be like, you would hear, you know, whispers about, yeah, no, we can't have Four Corners play there because the crowd's going to be too dark. You know what I mean? Like shit like that, where I and my partner at that time took intentional measures to break that. So for like a year, we came suited up. We would put on blazers, button up shirts, be the dress, best dressed people in the club, in any club we went to. And we even, like, we're not brothers, we were just friends, but, like, we dressed like twins. Like, we would wear the exact same thing. So no matter where we went, even when we were not DJing, people would be like, yo, who are those guys? What do? They look like they do something. And we just built this reputation that was undeniable. And then I made this one mixtape called The Mashup Theory, which was, still one of my favorite things that I've ever done. It literally was a mix of every kind of music, old and new, in a way that nobody, at least in this city, had done at that time. There's other DJs doing it other places, but like nobody had done it here. And with that CD, you could never brand us as hip hop DJs because yes, there was hip hop on there, but there was like all kinds of other stuff on there too. Mixing Drake with Maroon 5 and stuff like that. Like they'd never heard anything like that. Mm-hmm. That kicked in the doors for us to get into all these other clubs that didn't want to let us in. And from when we got in there and we tore it up and all the girls loved us and everything was going great, then we stopped wearing what we were wearing and started going back to wearing our baggy shit. And it was too late. They couldn't not have us there because we were making the money at that point. Mm. You know what I mean? So like, but in all of that, there's always been circumstances where I had to say no and walk away from something. I had to walk away from the government. You remember Circa Nightclub?
It sounds very familiar.
Circa was like the competitor to the government that a legendary club owner named Peter Gation from New York came and built. It's a Marshalls now down on John Street.
Yeah, that looks like a club. It was a beautiful club,
and it was the competitor to the government.
Got you.
When I quit the government, a couple weeks later, they booked me and hired me to be a resident there. Gosh, yeah. And then that club ran into financial situation where mans weren't getting paid. They didn't have money. Nobody was getting paid. So we had to walk away from that. Then there was a time I got a radio show on, I'm not going to name the station, but I got a show that was like not Flow. Right? I've been on Flow too, but I got on a station with not Flow, had a wider reach, better signal, all that. They're like, do what you do. And then in time, because of the nature of radio changing, because streaming has become more popular and radio stations are like trying to figure out what to do, they were like shrinking their playlist. Mm. So they were not allowing me to do what I do anymore. They were like, only play this. Mm-hmm. Only play this. It was when they told me, don't play any Canadian music, that I was like, that's it for me.
Don't play any Canadian
music. They were like, yo, we'll play Canadian music in other hours. During the mix show, don't play any Canadian music.
Interesting.
Because we don't want people to change the channel. You know the rules about in Canada, you have to play a certain percentage of Canadian music. What a lot of radio stations were doing, and probably still do, I don't know, I don't listen to radio that much anymore, is stack the Canadian songs
to one side
at like late at night or early in the morning. So be like, what? We played it. You know what I mean? But like, it's not during peak hours where they were concerned. Or to be honest, it's probably not that much anymore because there are big, globally famous Canadian artists now that they can lean on, like the Drakes and Weekends and, you know, Shawn Mendes and Bieber and all that stuff, the Jesse Reyes. They can play a lot of artists now in prime times. But at that time, it wasn't quite that yet. And I made a choice. I was like, well, I'm not going to be able to do the show anymore.
Wow.
Walked away from that. But everything always worked out because the decisions I made were always about, like, what am I actually trying to do here? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not just here for a check. I'm here to, like, make an impact. I'm here to live a happy life and, like, do what I love.
Yeah, kind of like the 20 million streams you've made this year, you know, on Spotify.
24 million.
24 million. Excuse me, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, independently, making music that I love to make.
So you're unsigned, making 24 million streams per year on Spotify alone.
That's Spotify alone, yeah. Spotify is the big window. The bulk of my streams are from Spotify. Mm-hmm.
Most definitely. So let's touch on that. I want to touch on you as an investor. I know you invest into some companies as well. So when did you become the artist side of Four Corners? I know you've always been an artist as a DJ, but it feels like there's been a push to becoming an artist over the last year. Talk to me about that.
Well, gradually, it happened gradually. Like, I want to say, like, maybe 8-9 years ago, I started dabbling in, you know, making edits and remixes and trying to figure out production. Mm-hmm. I did something in 2014 that was, like, supposed to be a remix for a friend's mixtape that he loved so much. He was like, yo, what if we drop this on SoundCloud as a song instead of just putting it on the mixtape as a remix? Mm-hmm. And, like, I flipped the song David Banner's song Play.
Don't play with it.
I flipped that and replayed the Beamer, Benz, and Bentley. Yeah. And like put like a different kind of, I made it 100 beats per minute and like put a different kind of production, like drums behind underneath it, and released it and called it Work. Like chopped up the vocals. He says Work in it. He says Work That. I just took Work and like made that, and we called it Work, and it blew up, and all these big DJs around the world were starting to play it. Like the first big thing was DJ Snake played it on BBC Radio on his first ever mix when he was coming up, because I met Snake in Paris when I was talking about like when I first started playing in Paris. So all of that was happening, and I was like, shit, maybe I should actually pay attention to this production thing. But it took me a while to like get really good at it. That was like, I don't want to say that was a fluke, but like I wasn't ready with anything else after that. So I didn't have any follow up. Mm-hmm. So I had to go back to the drawing board, and like that one was special. A lot of the other stuff that I did was not special. Mm-hmm. It was not good. A lot of shitty records, but learning. And then I would say the real decision maker was like 2019 when I put out a couple records that I was like, no, I feel good now. I feel good enough to stand on this and really, you know, I'm not a DJ that kind of makes music. Like I'm a producer and an artist from henceforth. And I just never look back. And it's still, you know, it took a few years to like really get going, but the more you do something, the more reps you get in, the more, you know, the 10,000 hours and all that
showing up
started to really show up. And now I feel great about the music that I make and I'm getting the feedback from people that, you know, it's impacting something. It's doing something out there.
Most definitely. Most definitely. How did the relationship with you and Connor come about?
We met online on Twitch during the pandemic.
On Twitch.
Yeah, yo. That's crazy. A mutual DJ friend, or not a mutual friend, my DJ friend, Andre 905, came across a song that Connor did with Idris Elba during the pandemic and sent it to me. And at first I ignored it because I didn't even see the email. I didn't take it in properly. And then he called me. He's like, no, you got to check this one out. This guy's from Toronto. He did a song with Idris Elba and it's dope. And I checked it out. I was like, yo, it is dope. At that time, this pandemic. We're all trying to figure things out. And I started doing this podcast, a live podcast on Twitch with my homie DJ Alizé, who was based in Edmonton. And we would just interview artists. And Connor was the first artist that we interviewed on there. We hit it off, stayed in touch, just kept talking, and we're like, oh, we should, you know, make a song, or we should make some music together. Mm-hmm. And we ended up remotely making a song called Marathon and put it out, and it was like doing okay at first, and then it started to really pick up steam. When it hit 1 million streams, this is the day that I flew. He lives in Las Vegas. He's from Markham, but he lives in Las Vegas and had not been to Canada throughout the whole pandemic. He was pretty much stuck there.
I mean, it's not a bad place to be stuck.
Not a bad place to be stuck. But he's not even a party guy. So like he's outside of Vegas. But I went and visited him. I happened to be in Phoenix and realized, well, the song's gonna hit 1 million this week. So I went to Vegas and we met for the first time in person at that time. And since then we just like kept building and kept working on stuff, and yeah, it's grown. And then Marathon is my biggest stream song to this point. It's like 21 million streams at this point.
That's insane, bro.
Congrats. And we made that as, thank you, and we made that as internet friends.
That's crazy. It's the power of the internet, right?
Yeah.
All right, so let's cap off on your investing, you know? Mm. What have been some of the best investments you've made?
Well, the most promising one that I'm most excited about right now is a company called Muse. Mm. It's a digital Web3 platform for musicians. Mm. So it's a startup. It's in development right now. Mm-hmm. Partnered with an art, the CEO of it is, her name is Alina. She goes by Alien U mm-hmm. online. Mm-hmm. And the idea came from, she's been in the Web3 space for a while. She was actually a part of a company called Liquid Marketplace that what they did was take high-valued collectibles and put them on the blockchain for people to own pieces of. So like super expensive Pokemon cards or, you know, sports cards or whatever, like a, you know, a LeBron James rookie card as an example that regular you and I's would not be able to afford because they're, you know, a $1 million card or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. The concept of this company was to be able to allow people to like essentially buy fractions of the ownership and own it together. Mm-hmm. And Logan Paul got involved in this company and like helped grow it. It's still going, but she jumped out because she's not passionate about Pokemon cards. She's a music person. So she came to me and a few others with this idea of like, yo, what if we did this, took this technology and applied it to music, to videos, to experiences, and allowed artists to be able to monetize better than the streaming services allow for, but also to be able to connect directly with fan bases. Because like the way that that works, if somebody buys your digital token, your NFT, so to speak, you have their information now. Mm-hmm. You can contact them. You can link them directly and be like, yo, thank you, Alex, for buying this. If you were somebody who like bought a few things, I could be like, yo, Alex, you're a real one. Here's free tickets to my show when I come to your city. So like that's the premise of this platform. It's called Muse. It's going to be launching this year. And I'm the most excited about it because I think that it's a great, great idea for artists and also for music lovers because you can get involved in the artist that you love's career and actually help them, you know, progress mm-hmm. because what you do, you know, it's similar to like buying a t-shirt or whatever. Mm-hmm. The artist actually sees more money than if you stream their music on Spotify as an example. Mm-hmm. Cause I don't know if you know what we make from streams.
It's like
it adds up.
Yeah.
But only when you're getting into the millions.
Yeah.
So like for an artist who's getting, you know, 10, 20,000 streams per song, they're not going to be able to live on that.
At all.
Not even close.
Yeah. And how does it work with features on streaming too? Like, is there like a split that happens with a song and then?
Yeah,
then
that's like, all. That's all in the paperwork when you make the song and you make those decisions amongst the people that are involved in making the song.
Yeah, I feel you.
Yeah. But like the way that it'll work on Muse mm-hmm. is similar. You make those decisions, but like instead of fractions of a penny, you're going to be splitting up like actual dollars. So you can see money for real mm-hmm. and like you as a music fan, if you discover an artist that's like, you know, on the come up and you really like what they do, you can actually put some money down to be a part of their journey. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to like be in communication with them, mm-hmm. but also you adding to that helps them. It's kind of like Patreon mm-hmm. where like that helps them to be able to do this full time versus only sometimes. If you really love it
yeah.
and you want them to give you more, you can help them get there versus, oh, I get it, they got to work their day job so they can only do this sometimes and maybe they drop a project every 2 years or something. Mm-hmm. It's like you can actually help artists progress.
Yeah, and you can sell it yourself too, no?
Yeah, there's a secondary ownership of that. Like if you want to, you know, if you get on with an artist super early and they blow up, now having that is valuable because there's like a limited amount. Mm-hmm. And if you want to part with it, you can. And the artist also gets a commission on that exchange.
Exactly.
So everybody wins, honestly. So this is like my biggest, most important investment I think that I've made. And I'm like I said, I'm the most excited about it.
That being said, that wraps up the podcast. The podcast is what you can't control. So control your grind. I control your life. I'm Alex.
I am Four Corners of the World.
That's the show, y'all. Peace.